Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You want to understand the death cults you're up against in Chicago? The kind of thinking you're up against in Chicago. This letter to the editor in the Wall Street Journal from Rob Frisch of Chicago. He writes in response to what Kibzinski, the CEO of McDonald's, had to say at the Economic Club last week, which we discussed, and the Wall Street Journal editorial board opined on what Kibzinski had to say, basically talking about crime and the lawlessness of the city, and McDonald's isn't in Chicago for altruistic purposes. Our shareholders wouldn't tolerate that. So, you know, in a very polite way, get it together. Where's the plan? These are the things that the McDonald's CEO had to say in his address to the Economic Club. Rob Frisch responding to the editorial on the topic. Your editorial, McDonald's and the Crisis of Chicago, says that Chicagoans shouldn't tolerate the city's increasing crime rate and public disorder. This makes me think of a recent experience I had in my upscale neighborhood on the north side of Chicago. Unprovoked and in broad daylight, a mentally ill homeless man backed me against a wall and threatened to kill me. Later, I told a young neighbor about the interaction and recommended she keep her distance from the man. The police couldn't detain him because of COVID-19 regulations. Her response? You called the police? I hope he's okay. Her empathy wasn't with the law-abiding neighbor standing before her whose life had been threatened. She is a representative of the progressive voters Mayor Lightfoot and Governor Pritzker are courting. Don't count on Chicago improving anytime soon.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Prey identifying with predator. That's, I mean, it's a simple vignette, and it speaks to so much of Chicago. It goes back to the guy who was quoted in the Tribune a couple of months ago that we've mentioned a couple of times. Walking in the loop and gets winged by a stray bullet in the hand. Hey, that stuff's going to happen in the city. That's just city living. You're going to get, you know, you're walking around, you're going to get shot. I mean, that's just, you know, that's what you get in exchange for nice restaurants. The trade-off.
We laugh so we don't cry, really. I mean, that is so pathetic.
Mm-hmm. Jamie Calvin is some sort of half-assed journalist writing the Chicago Tribune about my ad for the PAC that I operate, the Scream ad. Yes, the left is still
their panties are in a bunch over this.
Yes.
You're hurting people. One person called into WGN Radio because I was listening on Friday, and I was on hold, by the way, because I wanted to defend you.
You were calling into WGN Radio?
Yeah.
Oh.
Amy from Mount Prospect.
You're about 25 years too young to listen to WGN, but okay, go ahead.
And this one lady called in front of me, and they never took my call, and she said that, I fell asleep on the couch, and I woke up to somebody screaming, and I don't need to hear that. I had nightmares because of that ad, and I thought, oh my. And then Lisa Dent acted like she's never seen crime in Chicago. She said, well, I'm in the know in this town. And I'd never seen that.
I don't know who that is.
Oh, she's a host
Oh.
at the show.
Okay.
And she said she had never seen that ad before. And she's in the know. So if she's never seen that ad before, then how dare you put that ad out because it disturbed her too.
First of all, what do you mean she's never seen the ad before?
She never saw it before it became a part of a campaign.
No, she never saw the video of the attack.
The video of the attack, yeah. Which is a joke if you're in the know. How could you not see that?
Yeah.
You don't follow CWB? You don't watch the news on Labor Day? Like I did, I watched every station. Every single station had that repeatedly on the air.
Right, so...
Because it happened Sunday.
You called the police. I hope the guy who threatened your life is okay.
Oh, my God.
The ad, not the underlying attack, is what we should focus on. And that's what Jamie Calvin, this half-assed, self-styled journalist, does in the Chicago Tribune. The ugly aims of the Lakeview Scream ad. Viewed on its own terms as an exercise in the dark art of racist fear-mongering for political ends, the ad is perversely effective. Although we cannot tell for sure, we assume the three attackers are men and we assume they're black.
The only person that assumed that was Governor Pritzker. And my police officer friend said, I'd be careful. We never said they were black.
Well, you can't tell from the... I mean, I don't know what the police know about these three, but you can't tell from the video itself. And... Wait, so again, the ad is, which just presents what happened.
Right.
That's an exercise in the dark art of racist fear-mongering, even though there's no mention of any, there's no mention of race. I've never mentioned race. And in fact, I pushed back when Governor Pritzker took the same position as Calvin. How do you know? How do you know that black? And why do you want him to be black?
No,
why do you assume?
They need them to be black. So that they can say that you're racist.
So I'm, racist fear-mongering, and he says in the next breath, we assume they're black. Why? I mean, in terms of on a percentage basis, like, you know, playing the odds. But as for a specific incident, when you don't know, why would you make that assumption? You don't know.
It could be Hispanic.
And you well, it could be white. It could be, I don't, it could be anything. But that's not even the point. It's not even the point.
That's not why you, I mean.
So that's how he starts this piece. And then he goes on to offer his own experience with crime. He and his experience and his wife's experience with crime.
Oh, what happened?
The piercing screams of the woman in Lakeview who was attacked. Her piercing screams have a particular resonance for me because I hear them in the voice of my wife. On a Sunday morning earlier this summer, we were the victims of a similar crime outside our home in Kenwood. They were about to get ready to travel. They're waiting outside for a ride to the airport. Car came speeding down the street toward me. The car stopped, at which point three masked men jump out. One had a handgun extended. They rushed toward me. It all happened very fast. What do you want? I asked the man with the gun. What do you got? He replied. I gave him my wallet. At that moment, my wife emerged from our building. Some man pointing a gun at my chest began to scream. The other two men ran toward her. They ripped her bag from her shoulder, grabbed her cell phone, injuring her hand in the process. Then they sped away. Calvin writes, the episode left us with sensory scars we continue to nurse. For my wife, the recurring image as she experienced it of me about to be shot. For me, the echoing of her screams. It also left us with the knotty conundrum of how to understand and manage the presence of fear in our lives.
Manage it by moving.
It's these sorts of all-too-human confusions that the Lakeview Scream ad manipulates. The fact is that if the crime my wife and I endured had been captured on video, the producers of the ad may have seized on it for their purposes. Their ad is not an instance of disinformation. Oh, thank you so much. The incident it depicts really did happen to a woman on a street in Lakeview.
Yeah.
Such crimes are a matter of pressing concern. It goes without saying this is a legitimate exercise of freedom of speech. So why do I find the ad so reprehensible and at the same time worth interrogating? Because of the way it exposes the interface between the realities of violence and are often hallucinatory public discourse in which fear of violent crime is exploited for political gain. Then he raises the specter of Willie Horton. and of course ascribes it to George H.W. Bush, even though it was Al Gore in the primary who actually identified Willie Horton, and then H.W. Bush picked it up in the general. But I digress. The medium for this dangerous magic is fear that arises from our emotional cores and is animated by our deepest concerns for those we love and for our own survival. Fear of this nature overrides what else we know about our world. It blocks our capacity for perception and inquiry. It creates conditions in which ignorance can coexist with knowledge. Boy, this is really digging deep. The challenge, he writes, is not to live without fear, but to make it a vehicle for widening the lens through which we take in the world. As we consider the issue of crime and safety in the neighborhood, the critical question is, how spacious or cramped is our understanding of that neighborhood? Who are our neighbors? Are you my neighbor?
Can we be friends?
Yeah.
Get out the romper room mirror. I see criminals.
So,
I see neighbors.
So do you see this, I mean, this like pseudo-intellectual pablum spilled over the pages of the Chicago Tribune's which is, of course, nothing new there. But you see that the guy who wrote the letter to the editor, his neighbor, after hearing he was attacked and his life was threatened, telling her he called police, I hope the person you called police on is okay.
That sounds like Kim Fox, something she would say.
This guy, after having been robbed,
at gunpoint, a gun pointed to his chest,
and his wife being accosted and robbed this summer, you know, goes into this waxing philosophic about the definition of neighbor and the how fear animates our or distorts our understanding of the world around us and so on and so forth. You know, it's real simple. It's real simple. These people cannot confront the real world consequences of the things they espouse, particularly when they're turned into public policy. They can't confront it. They can't deal with it. They can't process it. This is the definition. This is sentimental barbarism. This is what I'm talking about when I use that term sentimentality, when I use that phrase sentimental barbarism. This guy using every word he's ever looked up in a thesaurus in a 600-word op-ed, this guy's a barbarian. And so is that young person who told her neighbor who was attacked or who conveyed to her neighbor's attack that she had empathy for the attacker and not the victim. It's real simple.
That's why this kind of behavior continues, because we keep caring more about the suspect than the victim.
We can have the conversation about root causes and about rehabilitation, but in the first order, it's about criminals and victims. And you know how somebody's a criminal? They commit a criminal act. They violate somebody else. That's how you know. Criminal doesn't define me, man. I made a mistake once. Fine. This is about criminal behavior and victims. Criminal behavior and victims. That's it. And if you expect the government to get beyond that and to have some sort of, you know, firing line discussion of the nature of man that Jamie Calvin pretends he wants to have, well, they can't even get the criminal behavior and victims piece right. And you want them to, you know, be part of a debating society. Honestly, the death cult, I literally pray identifying with Predator.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The big guy, Mr. 10%, President Biden, tried to get away. But he just couldn't resist the question being yelled at him from the press corps about the border. So before he exited stage left, he came back to the podium to address it. The question, why are things so much worse at the border under you, Mr. President?
Why is the border more overwhelmed under your watch, Mr. President?
Because there are three countries that are never have, there are fewer immigrants coming from Central America and from Mexico. This is a totally different circumstance. What's on my watch now is Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. And the ability to send them back to those states is not rational. You could send them back and have them wait. We're working with Mexico and other countries to see if we can stop the flow. But that's the difference. Thank you.
What is he? Does he even know what he's talking about?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. That's the difference? I don't. You're going to have to expound, but he wouldn't. Probably because he couldn't.
That's not an answer. He doesn't even know what he's saying.
Well, first of all, I don't understand what the problem is. These are all your fellow travelers, Mr. President. You know, the Castro impersonators, Daniel Ortega, Maduro. I mean, these are the sorts of people that your party was lauding not so long ago, starting with Comrade Bernie. The economic miracle under Hugo Chavez, who, of course, preceded Maduro. Remember? No? You don't remember? Venezuela's had a bit of a displacement problem just recently. They had millions of people outflowing from that country for a decade. What are you talking about?
They can't even eat rodents because they're gone.
And, I mean, the caravans that made their way up to the border under President Trump, but then were rebuffed. I mean, does it matter if they're coming from Honduras or Guatemala or Cuba or Venezuela? What's the difference
or Haiti,
in terms of border security? What I don't understand what the difference is.
He doesn't know either.
That's your answer, though. That's your answer why it's so different, because we've never had migrants trying to get into the United States before. From Central and South American countries. Really?
Does he even know that 2 million plus have come in since he's been president? It's a lot of people.
Ron DeSantis was asked about the politics of this because, of course, he's being accused of human trafficking from by people like Joe Biden and their, you know, his henchmen.
Yeah, it's the talking points from the Democratic Party, because Pritzker said it first, and then within hours, Gavin Newsom said it too, that human trafficking and possible kidnapping charges, and they want Merrick Garland to investigate.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kidnapping,
don't mind human trafficking,
don't mind his treating people. We heard this from Lightfoot and Pritzker, treating people as chattel.
Yeah, chattel.
It's inhumane and so on and so forth.
Don't, you know, they don't want him to investigate his son's laptop or anything, Hunter Biden stuff, but they want him to investigate DeSantis and Abbott for kidnapping charges.
Well, this is sort of what we were talking about on the issue of domestic crime here locally before Mike Scott's newscast. The don't pay attention to the substance of the issue. Pay attention to my selective outrage. And Ron DeSantis responded to the selective outrage of the media and the left. I repeat myself. And also reiterated the very simple proposition that seems to logically follow the declaration of yourself as a sanctuary.
When our middle son, Brandon, left to go to...
That's not it.
Where is it?
Where, do we have Ron DeSantis? I guess we're efforting Ron DeSantis. David in Lansing.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Can I try to translate Biden's comments? I'm going to try here so I can clarify. I want to help you guys out. Okay, you ready? Number one, the election is only, what, 42, 41 days away? They need voters now. So we need to open up the borders. Number two, we need distractions. Don't you realize the Hunter laptop stories resurfacing and Facebook is continuing to try to cover up the cover-up. So we need distractions. Stuff pouring over the border distracts. Come on, guys. And, you know, we want to look like less racist. So we need to let in, like, everything. We need to check all boxes, let everything in. The more diversity, the better. Don't you get it? Come on.
Yeah, I don't know about the vote. Thanks for the call.
Can't vote.
The voting thing, they're going to have some material impact on the midterms. I don't think so. You know, Charlemagne the God, this popular radio talk show host out of New York, he had an interesting take that generated some controversy because, you know, anything that doesn't amplify the virtue signaling of the left is controversial. So, you know, all of this, what Republicans should be doing is challenging the sanctuary state and city politicians, these Dems, because they don't really want the immigrants here either. They just use them. I mean, he didn't say this explicitly, but he's basically making the point. They're just using them as mascots. They're just using them as cudgels to say, look at the Republicans, they're racist, because that's all that the left has to say on, well, just in general. That's their go-to on virtually every topic. Rich, Indian Head Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I agree with you 100%. What is the difference of who is coming into the country? He has total control. If he closes the border, these people won't be coming in. How can he pick and choose which group of people could come in? It doesn't make any sense. They're all illegal, and they're all causing a problem in the country. And he wants to go ahead and blame it on other people, blame it on the governors for sending them to different places. He doesn't make a bit of sense at all.
Thanks for the call, Rich. Well, here's the thing. I mean, you said, well, what's your solution? Nobody offers a solution. Ron DeSantis, Greg Abbott don't have a solution. Well, actually, they do. And DeSantis has repeated it a couple of times now in the last few days as this has come into focus for everyone. And it's remain in Mexico, a return to the remain in Mexico policy that existed under Trump. They say, well, they're not just Mexicans. Well, I know, but here's the thing. The Biden administration sent the message to make your way to the border and essentially, we're going to find a way to let you in, and you're not going to have to remain in Mexico, so you're going to be able to come in pending your asylum application, which we know, as we talked about earlier this week, can take years to adjudicate, years even for your first hearing on the topic, which is another failure of our legal regime that governs immigration here. But that's a message. That's a policy that says, don't come here. Because understand, you're not coming in pending your asylum application. You're going to have to remain in Mexico And yes, we should work with the Mexican government to make necessary provisions, particularly for those who have legitimate, colorable asylum claims. But don't think that you're coming in and you're going to be able to move about the country freely. That would dissuade a lot of people from coming who are otherwise rolling the dice to make the trek to the border, whether it's from Mexico or from other countries, or and not just in this hemisphere either, as we know. So that actually is a policy proposal that hasn't been taken up by the press corps because, you know, they're focused on their selective outrage.
I haven't heard a peep about all the people that have been told by Biden you can just come in, and they're going, they're being abused by the cartels, they're drowning in the Rio Grande. You had 50 that died in some shed in Texas. I heard no outrage about any of that. I haven't heard outrage about all the fentanyl that's come across the border that's killing Americans in record numbers. I don't hear outrage about the criminal aliens that have gotten through and have then victimized people, not only in Florida, but all throughout the country. I didn't hear any outrage about that. The only thing I hear them getting upset about is you have 50 that end up in Martha's Vineyard. Then they get really upset. And I'm sorry. Those migrants were being treated horribly by Biden. They were hungry, homeless. They had no opportunity at all. The state of Florida, it was volunteer, offered transport to sanctuary jurisdictions because it's our view that, one, the border should be secured. And we want to have Biden reinstitute policies like remain in Mexico and making sure that people aren't overwhelming. But short of that, if you believe in open borders, then it's the sanctuary jurisdictions that should have to bear the brunt of the open borders. So that's what we're doing. But what happened was...
Yeah, so it seems to logically follow, doesn't it? You want open borders, you declare yourself a sanctuary, come one, come all, at your discretion, on your terms. Well, okay, well, so why wouldn't we move these people over to you when you're waving your hands around saying, come one, come all, bring them here?
And I don't know why they're not delivering these, you know, asylum seekers to California. Why isn't that on their list? That should be done today, if not sooner. Because Gavin Newsom, you know, he's all out for DeSantis.
I think this appropriately belongs to the Department of Justice, and Merrick Garland should take a close look at it. Turns out I was not the only one. There was a chorus of folks shortly thereafter when we announced the letter that we had sent to Merrick Garland that are arguing similarly.
Yeah, of course there's a chorus of folks because you're all reading from the same playbook. You all have reciting the same talking point. Of course there's a chorus of folks. Phil and Darian, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. Listen, I got a question. Can't anybody seek asylum? Anybody. It doesn't matter if you're a gang member, thug. I'm seeking asylum. I want a better life.
Well, this is why you have immigration judges that adjudicate these applications, right? You don't automatically get in just because you're declaring I'm an asylum seeker. Your application has to be adjudicated. And one of the failures of the system, to repeat, is that we don't process these applications nearly fast enough.
Well, you're saying they can't just get in because they want to get in, but they're in.
So this is part of the rub, is to say, okay, you are making an application for asylum. Where do you wait out that adjudication period? Do you get to move around the country at your leisure and with the idea that you'll show up for your hearing 2 years from now? Is that the way we're going to do it? Or are we going to have a remain in Mexico or a remain in your country of origin pending your asylum application process? Exigent circumstances, if somebody is literally literally under threat of death, then, okay, in their country of origin, okay, well, then you work with a friendly government to, you know, make some accommodations best you can. But the idea that the only play, which is the open border left's posture, the only play is to your point, Phil, is everybody's going to say I'm an asylum seeker. Some claims are legitimate. Most will turn out not to be legitimate. They are not facing you know, threat of death or great bodily harm. And but they're going to be in this country for 2 years. They're going to be able to call their own shots, operate on their own terms. They show up for their hearing. They don't show up for their hearing. Now what, you're going to have border agents roaming the country trying to identify all of these people when they're coming in, the clip they're coming in. Of course, that's not realistic. It's not pragmatic. It's not a workable system. That's what that's exactly what we're talking about. That's what DeSantis is talking about as well. Thanks, Phil. Mike Union.
Hey, good morning. How would Martha's Vineyard like if, like, 50 MS-13 gang members showed up, you know, in their community? Do you think they'd be all happy and glad and, oh, we're glad they were here? And how about the drugs if, like, a bus full of drugs showed up in these communities? You know, DeSantis has it right. But that's where it needs to, you know, in your face. It won't happen, but, I mean, maybe they need a little wake-up call, because the 50 people that went there weren't harming anybody. They're, you know, probably good people, but they're still illegal aliens. And, yeah, maybe show them some gang members with tattoos all over their faces and see how they like it then.
Well, thanks for coming. You know, how many angel moms and dads are out there who've had a family member killed by somebody in this country illegally?
Yep.
And often repeatedly in this country illegally, and often the individual had committed other crimes. DeSantis has an ad up right now with a mom talking about losing her son to a person in this country illegally.
When our middle son, Brandon, left to go to work, he was only 21 years old, and the last words I said to him is, I love you, and a twice deported illegal ran into him and hit him so hard that he caused Brandon's car to flip, and he killed him. My child's killed by someone who should not have been here. This is what happens when we have open borders.
You've seen the ads that I've run featuring Brian McCann, the brother of Denny McCann, who was killed in Chicago by a person in this country illegally, was given sanctuary by Cook County, by Tony, and then was able to flee to Mexico, and his brother's killer has never been brought to justice.
And he never will be.
When Bronner signed sanctuary state legislation, when Ronner, the Republican, signed sanctuary state legislation, Jeannie Ives, her campaign, ran a commercial featuring not just Brian McCann, but also Eric Brady, his wife, Jeannie Brady. They're down in central Illinois, Mahomet, down by Champaign. Coming back from work, she's killed by a person in this country illegally from Central America who went the wrong way on an off-ramp and killed her. Coming back from working as she was working as a bartender at the local VA, at the local Legion Hall, I think.
Yeah.
And then he, again, provided sanctuary by Champaign County, fled, and his wife's killer has never been brought to justice. We can't even do that. All these things that we say we can do because the virtue signalers and their magical thinking, this is the kind of world I've created in my mind, so it should just be that way. Well, it's not. And these are the real world consequences, like that mom you just heard from in the DeSantis ad, the two families I mentioned, there are many more. We can't even do that right. We can't even expel people who've committed violent crimes. We can't even bring people to justice who've committed violent crimes against Americans, black, white, and other. Ron and Carol Stream.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, in that press conference, Biden said, oh, this is totally different. It's not people from Central America and Mexico. Well, no, he's right. The Venezuela and Cuba are not from there. But Nicaragua is part of Central America. This guy is such an idiot. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Ron.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I hesitate to share this story because I'm afraid it could inhibit the few people who are willing to actually speak up in this city and state. We need more voices, not fewer, and I'm afraid this may give people that have concerns enough of a reason to not make their voices heard, their opinions known. But I feel like I should tell it anyway. Stephen DeFilippis is a wealth management guy. Been for 30 years, got an office in Wheaton. He appeared in one of the commercials I've been running as part of this series called Business Speaks. Maybe you've seen them.
It's very effective.
Different business owners. We had Spiro from Kai's in Glendale Heights. We've had Tom Sedaka featured. We've had Steve and others. We've had Steve DeFilippis featured. Here's the radio and TV, but here's the 30-second version on TV that you may have seen and heard.
Abysmal. J.B. Pritzker has done an abysmal job. It's just amazing how he comes on television with these ads just lying through his teeth about how great Illinois is doing. And when you look at the actual facts, and you know, my business is wealth management, so I understand numbers and finance, etc. And the state is seriously, deeply in debt. I really question whether there is a way for them to get out of it. The time to change is now.
Is that a particularly incendiary message to you?
Oh, please don't. What happened to him?
And
because we're watching him right now, he's on Channel 9.
Yeah.
Same ad is airing right now as we speak.
Yeah. Is that a particular controversial opinion that he has?
No,
Illinois is in financial trouble. Has anybody heard that before? That we could be doing better fiscally in Illinois, both in the public sector and the private sector?
We don't know what the word surplus means, yes.
So in response to that, and by the way, you know, real people talking, who live real lives, who've made a real life for themselves in this state, who've contributed mightily to this state through their, you know, business and raising a family and so forth.
Only to have it taken away with corrupt politicians like Pritzker, but, you know.
So you want actors playing a part? You want the flim-flam? Or do you want, like, somebody who just faced a camera, hey, Steve, what do you think about what's going on? And then somebody like me amplifies that opinion because I think it's shared by millions of Illinoisans. And a lot of people need to know that they're not the only ones who see things for how they are, who have these very rational, fact-based opinions. And so the response has been by the left to DeFilippis to go on Google and give his financial firm bad reviews, cast all kinds of aspersions on him. Then there's a guy who has a electric contracting company who's left three voicemails at his office making veiled threats. There's a realtor in Lincoln Park who called his home screaming at him. And now his wife and his son are concerned about, well, their privacy, their
safety,
the family business. I don't do this, so you don't see me arguing or telling people, go, anybody who appears in a Pritzker ad, all those women in a Pritzker ad, all those pro-abortion women
go
carrying on
down.
And right. saying things that are untrue. Go, you know, go find out where they live and what they do and go harass them and give, if they own a business, give them bad reviews on Google and whatever else, you know, if it's a restaurant, yeah, so on and so forth. You know, target them, go after them personally.
Yeah, make their life hell.
Nobody said that.
That's what they want to do.
Nobody said that. Doesn't happen. But I
are those even real Illinoisans that are in his ad?
I think some of them That's are. I know who one of them is. So at least, so I know I don't know all of them.
I was
but
just
I know,
curious.
Yeah, which is fine. That's good. Fine. It's fair game. And if you want to have those opinions and that's what you want to amplify and make that your value proposition as a candidate or as a party, fine. Not fine, though, if you do it from a fiscally conservative perspective. So the people that are harassing Steve DeFilippis, two of them, I want to tell you who they are, since they've made themselves so, well, since they've decided to go after DeFilippis personally. You know, these are people I do want you to pay attention to. Maybe reach out to, give a review, leave a phone message saying, we don't appreciate what you're doing. What you're doing is wrong. That's it. No threats. No, nothing silly. You're not a good person. What kind of person calls the home of somebody who appears in a television ad and they disagree with the opinion to scream at them? What kind of person does it? I'll tell you what kind of person does it. A person named John Ruder, R-U-D-E-R, who's a realtor of all things, public facing, at Properties, part of the Tom Moran Group at Properties. John Ruder, R-U-D-E-R, native of north suburbs of Chicago. I'm reading from his bio at Properties. He's lived in Wrigleyville, Gold Coast, blah, 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 blah. He went to University of Indiana. Graduated with a degree in sociology. No wonder he's a realtor. Blah, 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 blah. Oh, he's a top producer at Properties. Yeah.
Ruder.
He's also a terrible human being. He's also a infant who can't tolerate somebody who doesn't want to vote to reelect J.B. Pritzker for whatever reason. But, I mean, for fiscal management reasons. John Ruder, R-U-D-E-R. I'll tweet it out, too, so people can review and comment as they see fit. Another guy, the guy that left these ranting voicemails at the office, his place of business. He's got a place of business. Robert Schumacher Electric, S-C-H-U-M-A-C-K-E-R. Schumacher, S-C-H-U-M-A-C-K-E-R. Schumer Electric in Lombard. Robert Schumacher. Mm-hmm. No, I guess, well, I don't know. Lombard's got a Villa Park address. Yeah. Robert Schumacher. You know, it's about time that people rally to the fence of people who are going to stand up, who do stand up if you're not going to stand up yourselves. At least that's what I think. And so I hope that someone listening, people listening, if they don't know who these two individuals are, and I hope somebody does, and I hope somebody tells them, and we'll try to amplify them as much as possible. Who knows? They may be featured in an ad before all is said and done. You want to have a discussion about civil discourse? About dealing on the substance of things, not just devolving to the ad hominem. Yeah. Keep lecturing me about that. leftists. Keep with the lecturing. This is who they actually are. This is what they actually do. This is a real-world example. All of their high-mindedness and we're good, they're bad, and we're saving democracy. Right. We're saving democracy. We're saving lives. So the ends justify the means. And if we have to ruin some lives, if we have to harass some people, if we have to destroy some businesses, well,
too bad.
That's the price of ending racism. That's the price of saving lives.
312-642-5600, turnkey Depro, answer line 64636. Type in DA and then a quick comment. Why do they care that much to defend Pritzker like that and harass people?
I don't care how dyed in the wool of a supporter you are of any politician or anything. Well, what kind of person calls somebody they don't know because they appeared in a television commercial to harangue them because they disagree with their viewpoint? Calls them at home. Tries to undermine their business, their business's reputation by just saying, you know, he's a liar, he's a scumbag, he's this, he's that. Why? Because he criticized J.B. Pritzker.
Hey.
I mean, hey, you know, this is not illegal, you know, short of making material threats, not illegal. But again, do you want that turned on you? Is this the sort of tit for tat that you want in our politics? You want this to be what we redefine as civil discourse, since we're in the business of redefining everything else? I mean, because, you know, I'm happy to get down into the mud or take it to the street. I'm happy to do that. And I'm fortunate in my position. I was having this conversation yesterday with somebody. You know, it's I'm sort of in the unusual position where the more people hate on me or go after me, the better it is for me because I'm a radio talk show host. And most people aren't in that position where the more people pay attention to them to attack them or their business or their family, the better it is for them. No, for most people, that makes life a lot less better, a lot worse, right? Not for me. So this is why I invite it, and this is why mainly they steer clear, because they can't get to me, but they can get to other people. Responsible, productive people who are sharing their viewpoint because they care about the future of the city, the state, their country, and they're met with the mob. How many times have we been talking about this? How many examples have we given of cancel culture over the last, well, 5 years, let's say, in particular? It precedes the last 5 years by many decades, but the last 5 years in particular, where it's become sport for people who simply never matured beyond grade school. And that's an insult to a lot of grade schoolers who are more mature than these people we're discussing. The John Reuters of the world and the Robert Schumachers of the world. Tina and Joliet, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I just want to applaud you for doing this. It's been a long time coming. The left has done this to us for the most minor, just like you said, this guy came out and stated publicly what we all know to be true. And now the mobs are going to come after him and his family. They have absolutely no moral compass whatsoever. But as you were talking, I wrote down the name, and this sounds like a job for Speaker Carr. But my
Speaker Carr.
All of a sudden, I got a text message from another friend of mine with a screenshot of the names as well. So yeah, good job. Keep it up, and it put them all on blast. People need to know what we've been dealing with for the last 6 years. Their entire goal is to silence you and drive you into the shadows, so they can keep destroying the state that we live. It's really horrific what they do to people. And if putting their names and faces out there maybe gives them pause before they decide to attack somebody's wife over comments somebody else said, keep it up. This is exactly what we need to do on the right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tina. David Winnetka.
Yeah, hi. From the years of about 2017, I think it was, till early 2020, I was an Uber driver in the city. BLM eventually hit. And anyways, just, you know, I drive a lot on the south side and the west side. And, you know, with observable reality, you see what was going on. And I started questioning the BLM movement of, you know, hey, you're amassing all this money, and yet these places are just run down and torn down, and you're not giving anything to the black community that you care so much about. So I bring up these, you know, conversations with passengers, and I get these young white liberal girls saying, you're a racist. And I'm like, I mean, here I am. Like, I mean, I got robbed twice. I got jumped once. I got run into with a passenger in my car, you know, and I'm like, well, I'm trying to help the black person here. What have you done for the black lady? But anyways, eventually Uber deactivated my account. And believe it or not, I was making over $100,000 doing that job.
Wow.
And it's just, you know, all microcosm of just the whole, you know, dynamic of the whole thing, how, the, you know, people are so afraid to speak out for anything because, boom, you lose it all. But at any rate, I love you guys. You guys are awesome. And thanks for letting me on. Appreciate you.
Thanks, David. Kathy in Paw Paw, Michigan.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I just wanted to tell you something. I know this has nothing, it's not as bad as what this poor man is going through. And thank you, Dan, for everything you do. I did call Laura Murphy's office. She's a state senator representing the Northwest Side suburbs. And I had asked the office, I said, did the senator vote yes or no on the Safety Act? Mm-hmm. And the person told me she voted no. And then I heard
it's
on
not
your
true.
Program last week.
Yeah.
I know. I heard on your program that all Democrats voted yes. So I called back, and they just took my name and number, and one of her little cronies called me the other day, and we got into it. I said, well, if the senator voted yes, when is she going to vote to repeal it? And he said, what's wrong with you? Are you against poor people? Poor people can't do a cash bail. I said, well, who does the crime? You know? And we got into it. The man got so upset with me. And now this is a representative of the state senator. He hung up on me, and he called me.
Mm-hmm.
So I know it has nothing to do with the severity that you're dealing with.
No, but it's the same attitude. It's, you know, if you
exactly.
don't agree, if you don't agree, I mean, especially from as you say, representing your elected official and
exactly.
not having time for you, you know, dismissing you if you disagree. If, first of all, lying to you initially that she didn't vote for it when she did.
And then
the attitude, you know, about you hate poor people. Is that discussing the issue on the merits? So let me understand. So 100 of the state's 102 county prosecutors hate poor people, including 26 of the 28 Democrat county state's attorneys. Is that what I'm to understand? Right.
He told me everything that I was saying to him was a lie.
Yeah.
And I did not understand
right.
the Safety Act. And
right.
I said, you know what? The problem is I do understand the Safety Act, and I hope that a whole lot of other people get it, too. Because this is going to be a real problem. That axe-wielding guy in New York, I don't know if you saw that. It was
yeah,
in New
oh,
York.
Yeah, yeah, McDonald's.
And he's
yeah.
out. He's
yeah.
out on
yeah.
that.
Yeah, of course he's out.
He didn't even have bail. He's
of
out.
Of course he's out.
So,
thanks for the call,
crazy
Kathy.
Crazy
axe-wielding
monster is out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Will Skokie.
Hey, how you doing? A couple things. Number one, the First Amendment particularly, specifically guards political speech. So this is an attack on political speech, which is much more than just censoring. Number two, you know, the guy, your guys, when you put up those ads, and I love them, by the way, you say the person's name and you give their job, not necessarily where they work, but, you know, they had political, you know.
Right.
The Pritzker ads for those old folks, Pritzker balanced the budget. Yeah, he balanced the budget because he got a bunch of COVID funds and the damn state was going bankrupt, and without COVID it would have gone bankrupt. They don't have their names there. They have where they live, like the town, but how many do? And it's just so, like you said, you control the media. if a tree falls in the woods and it's not reported on CNN, did it actually happen? That's the thing. And what you're doing is you have setting up your own CNN. Thank you very much for doing so. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Will. Pat Lockport.
Yeah, good morning, Dan. I want to thank you so much for calling out Reuter and Newsmaker. You know, where did they get their chutzpah from? Maxine Waters? Go after these people. Tell them they're not wanted here.
Right.
I mean, it's absolutely pathetic. And then you got the dumbass in Washington, 87,000 IRS agents, but you can't have judges adjudicating asylum issues. I mean, how stupid is the American public to even listen to this crap? That's what amazes me. And these so-called journalists, quote unquote, on any of the mainstream media, these talking points are repetitive over and over. Do they ever play back what they say?
Well, thanks.
They would crawl in a hole and not come out. Have a good day, kiddos.
Thanks for the call, Pat, kiddos. Yes, all right.
We will.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Bust it.
America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and let's bust a move on Vanderbilt University with the help of Matt Walsh. Matt Walsh is the blogger, talk show, podcaster, deal guy. Daily Wire? Is he with the Daily Wire? Used to be? I don't know. I don't remember. Don't care. He did a documentary, What is a Woman, that we played excerpts from. It's very good. He's been really strong on this, on the life issue. He's really strong on the life issue. He's also been really strong on other cultural issues, including this trans insanity. And boy, I thought our interview with Miss Dansky,
that was good.
The self-described radical feminist, you know, pro-abort,
liberal Democrat,
but the idea that a man pretending to be a woman is the same as a woman is preposterous, and she sees the dangers of this movement from the drag queen bingo story hour grooming to the mutilation of children in advance of a upside down political ideology. Well, where does this sort of stuff come from? Universities. Universities, pretty much. That's the starting point. Matt Walsh did a little bit of a look-see at one of the universities that has been most on the forefront of promoting transgenderism and the associated surgeries, because there's money to be made.
Yeah, it's a business, guys.
Some are ideologues and some are just mercenaries. Vanderbilt's Dr. Shane Taylor on the big money in trans surgeries. Take a listen to part of her presentation.
Starting in January 1st of 2017, according to the Affordable Care Act, insurance carriers are mandated to cover medical expenses for trans folks. Some of our BUMC financial folks in October of 2016, starting a couple of years ago, put down some costs of how much money we think each patient would bring in. And this is only including top surgery. This isn't including any bottom surgery. And it's a lot of money. These surgeries make a lot of money. So female to male chest reconstruction can bring in $40,000. A patient just on routine hormone treatment, who I'm only seeing a few times a year, can bring in several thousand dollars, because that requires a lot of visits and labs. It actually makes money for the hospital. Now, these I got from the internet, but it's from the Philadelphia Center for Transgender Surgery, which has does a lot of surgery for patients. And I just want to give you an idea of how much these bottom surgeries are making. And this is, I think this has to be an underestimate. This is for a vaginoplasty. They're quoting roughly around $20,000 for a vaginoplasty, but that doesn't include your hospital stay. That doesn't include your post-op visits. That doesn't include your anesthesia, inside your OR. So I would think that this has to be a gross underestimate. I think that's just like the surgeon's piece of it, which anybody who's ever been in a hospital knows that that's like 10% of it. And then the female-to-male bottom surgeries, these are huge money makers. Again, I think this has to be an underestimate that they're quoting around $20,000 for a phalloplasty. There's been different things that I've read that said it could be up to $100,000. Dr. Winokur, who's our surgeon, says that there's entire clinics where the entire clinic is supported just by their phalloplasties, and that is like a fraction of the surgeries that they're doing. These surgeries are labor-intensive, they require a lot of follow-ups, they require a lot of OR time, and they make money. They make money for the hospital.
Isn't that exciting? Did you hear anywhere in that discussion an address to patient outcomes?
No. It's all about the green cabbage.
Maybe.
That's like up to $100,000, wow, for the female bottom surgery.
Well, then also all the follow-ups.
Right.
Cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. Your
anesthesiologist, that's going to be added on to all that.
Yeah. Ringing the bell over and over again. It's great, isn't it?
Irreversible surgery, folks.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Dr. Ellen Clayton, she addressed those who may have some sort of moral or religious objection to this. moral religious objections to this, problematic. Don't have them.
If you are going to assert conscientious objection, you have to realize that that is problematic. You are doing something to another person, and you are not paying for the cost for your belief. I think that is a real issue. So I think, yes, Vanderbilt, if someone has a conscientious objection to participating in this sort of surgery, it would probably have to accommodate you to the extent that you can find another person who can do your job, who doesn't have an objection, other things of that nature. But I just want you to take home that saying that you're not going to do something because of your religious beliefs is not without consequences, and it should not be without consequences. And I just want to put that out there. We are given enormous. If you don't want to do this kind of work, don't work at Vanderbilt.
Monster.
If you don't want to do this kind of work, don't work at Vanderbilt. Moral objections, religious objections, problematic.
Yeah, comply or die. We
do
don't
not
need you here. Go somewhere else.
Do not have them. This is imposing consequences on people. Not the surgery, the religious or moral objection. Why do we have medical ethicists, bioethicists? Why do we have discussions about the ethics of a particular treatment or a particular research? Is that something that's unusual in the medical community? Didn't used to be. When you have a major institution like Johns Hopkins start doing transgender surgeries, gender reassignment surgeries, stop, then start again, does that raise any questions in your mind about what's driving these sorts of decisions? When you have a Brown University medical researcher whose research into the spike of trans identification among young people included a suggestion that much of the spike can be attributed to trans as a social contagion, and then that research was sidelined. Does research that that draws conclusions you don't like, is that an ethical issue in the medical community?
What about caring about the mental and social health of patients? Because it sounds like all they care about there is money. And if you don't like what they're doing, get another job.
Yeah, is doing something solely for money, regardless of the moral implications, Is that something you think about at all or no? Is that something that's legitimate to think about, I wonder? Well, it's a full court press for the Commodores. Dr. Shane Taylor, Dr. Ellen Clayton, the Trans Buddies Program. You ready for the propaganda now?
Uh-oh.
Now, that's the straight talk you got from the two docs. Now you ready for the happy propaganda? You have the beautiful lies? Cartoons to cover them. Trans Buddies!
My name is Sean Riley, and I'm the program coordinator for Trans Buddy at the Program for LGBTQ Health at Vanderbilt University. Trans Buddy provides trained peer advocates for transgender patients who are coming for doctor's appointments or other healthcare-related services. Whether you're looking for something that's related to medical transition, such as hormone therapy, or something completely unrelated, like breaking an arm or going to an ENT, we are here to help support any transgender patients that come through our doors. The Trans Buddy program was organically created through the efforts of transgender people and continues to consistently be led by trans people in Middle Tennessee. Trans Buddy program is a one-of-a-kind in the nation, and institutions are looking to Vanderbilt to replicate and expand programs like ours.
Oh, isn't that exciting?
Yeah. Oh, please. Replicate it. Wow.
One more, then we'll take some of your calls. This is a 2020 video from the Vanderbilt Psych Department. The topic is administering puberty blockers as early as the age of 18. This video presentation by plastic surgeon Julian Winokur and physician's assistant Shaylin Vanderbloemen. Yeah. Where they talk about things like, A, happy to perform double mastectomies on adolescent girls. Happy to do it.
So when we talk about the WPATH guidelines, so in order for our patients to really successfully undergo these surgeries, we do, again, follow these guidelines. So a lot of times it's for insurance purposes, but again, insurances kind of follow suit with the WPATH guidelines for the most part. So for any kind of top surgery, we do require one letter of persistent, well-documented gender dysphoria by a licensed mental health provider. We ensure that the patient is capable of making fully informed decisions on their own. They're the age of majority. However, for a lot of our younger patients, again, if they are 16, 17 here at Vanderbilt, if they have been on testosterone, have a parental consent, we're able to do a lot of the top surgeries for those patients.
Oh, no. That makes me cringy.
Mm-hmm. Since it's his diligence, let's give Matt Walsh the last word on what he uncovered at Vanderbilt. He tweeted, so let's review. Vanderbilt got into the gender transition game, admittedly in large part because it's very financially profitable. They then threatened any staff members who objected and enlisted a gang of trans activists to act as surveillance in order to force compliance. They now castrate, sterilize, and mutilate minors as well as adults, while apparently taking steps to hide this activity from the public view. This is what healthcare has become in modern America. Yeah.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Sue in St. Charles.
Good morning. I just want to make a couple comments. First of all, I'm opposed to this, but it doesn't surprise me, and I'm that you've got, I mean, unfortunately, hospitals are businesses. So if you're going to run a business, you're going to want to make money. So if you've got a group of doctors that are probably more administratively based, talking about the profits or the money that different procedures make, that doesn't blow me away. That's not surprising to me. And if you look at what's happening in our culture and our administration promoting all of this transgender phenomenon, then why wouldn't a hospital take advantage of that? If that's what the people want and people are going to go places to get these procedures, then, and it's completely promoted by everyone else in our culture, to me, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, I'm not surprised by it, but surprise isn't the question, is it? It's propriety. So, for example, if somebody was willing to take a patient who has body integrity dysphoria and wants to cut off their arm just because it's a mental disorder. Either that person is going to do it or they're going to find somebody else to do it for X amount of dollars, so we might as well.
Right. That's seriously, and it's like gastric bypass surgery. It's the same thing. I think that for a very select amount of people, that is appropriate. But for a lot of people, they need psychology, they need health and exercise, and you don't get a gastric bypass surgery because you go back to being obese 2 years later.
Right. But enough about Chris Christie, right?
When you eat your way through it.
No, I hear what you're saying. I mean, Sue, I hear what you're saying, but I think this is surprising to some people. I don't think people.
No, this is shocking.
I think people are not as far down the road on this as we think they are. And I also think, yes, I mean, you can intellectualize this. Hospitals are businesses; they need to make money, so on and so forth. But you know, doctors are always cast and medical professionals in this heroic role of just serving patients for the common good and not being motivated by profit or money like the rest of us. And this is not a criticism. This is just saying that they're like above this, the ugliness of doing things for money. And they're not. And people should understand that what the motivations are. I'm not saying it's the only one. And I'm not saying it's even the preeminent one for a lot of doctors. But it's certainly part of the conversation. And you're right. You're absolutely right. It's certainly the part of the conversation. It's the conversation at an administrative level when you're trying to run a hospital. Totally get that. But I don't think a lot of people see it that way. I think when you strip this away like these individuals did, I think it stuns people.
Well, it is stunning, but that's what our culture is becoming. So, I mean, I guess I just look at it and I think there are a lot of doctors that are opposed to this.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're an employee of a hospital, let's say, I commend that one person, that one doctor that says, look, if you have religious objections, you don't belong here at Vanderbilt. At least she was honest about it.
Yeah.
Not just firing people.
Yeah. Yeah. At least you know what you're getting into. Thanks for the call, Sue. Yeah. Yeah. This is not a place that respects your particular moral compass or, you know, particularly if it's informed by your faith, your religious beliefs. Yeah, no. Right. You know, there's a documentary series called The Detransition Diaries. It's produced by Jennifer Lahl. She's a former pediatric nurse. She's the current president of the Center for Bioethics. And Center for Bioethics and Culture Network. Her film tracks stories of three women who believe their mental and emotional trauma would be solved by transitioning to the opposite sex. They underwent hormone treatment. One had her breasts removed. And basically what she says is, we're following the news and the studies. The evidence shows this uptick in rapid onset gender dysphoria is something young girls are particularly prone to. And
wants their period.
They're getting pulled into this, and tracking these women who went down this road, as we've seen before, gets sort of muted by the D.C. press corps. As we've seen before, there's not good outcomes.
See this? It's barbaric. I mean, when they get their breasts removed, there's a scar that goes from underneath your left armpit all the way over to your right armpit, because they take out your nipples too to try to replicate what a men's chest looks like. It's disgusting.
Verlon, Southside.
I have the perfect name for this issue. It's an oldie but goodie. Nip Tuck.
It was also an FX series. Yeah.
How uncomfortable you must be in your own skin to put yourself through this mutilation. It must be an unhappy person.
Sad. Yeah.
Well, it's a mental illness.
Thanks.
And then they think it's easier being a woman, or they think it's easier going to be a man. It's not easier. Your problems are not going to go away when you transition, okay?
Mm-hmm. Hey. Yeah. Problems are like pancakes, as Dr. Phil likes to say. Those two sides. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Were you doing Bill Clinton there, or is that what you were doing?
Yeah, Dr. Phil.
It was a little bit of Bill Clinton. I mean, it kind of sounds similar. Yeah.
Well, anyway, my big question on this is, for these doctors, there are people who detransition who change their minds. I mean, you know,
I know when I was growing up that I was told, you know, you're going to be a different person at 21 than you are at, you know, 16 than you are, you know, you'd be different when you're 30. I mean, you change as a person just naturally. Your desires change, your priorities change just as a person, and your ability to reflect and think about and philosophize about your life changes as you get more experience as a person. And so there are going to be people who may go through this thinking that this is the thing that they need to do, and then later on, as they get older, they go, what did I do that for? So
yeah.
what is this doctors and these present, you know, people who presented, what is their response to someone who goes through that? I mean, I remember watching a video of one of these detransitioners, and she was really crying, and she was talking about she'll never be able to have kids, and, you know, she's just going to have scraps of a life that she could have had. And she was, you know, very despondent. This is psychologically scarring her now, and it probably will her entire life unless she learns to accept it. What about that? What about those people who change their minds 5 or 10 years later and think they made a wrong decision? What is their response to that? What is their thought process, or how do they answer that?
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call, Frank. It's a good question. We did the best we could at the time. We were just following our patients' wishes. You know, it's always the rationalization. People have an infinite capacity to rationalize their own conduct, no matter how barbaric. So that's, I suspect, what you get in part. But yeah, what we knew or should have known, the red lights that are being blown through here, really disturbing, to say the least. Disturbing.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've had a number of county state's attorneys and county sheriffs in Illinois weigh in on the Safety Act, or as it's now being perhaps more accurately called online, the Purge Law.
I love how they rename things.
I'm actually a little surprised we haven't heard from more state's attorneys and county sheriffs, given the dire straits this law would put Illinois, law-abiding Illinois families in, were it to take effect on January 1. Again, exporting the Chicago model of law enforcement to the rest of the state and making it the law of the land. Chicago is doing this by choice, the choices of Kim Fox and Tim Evans and Lori Lightfoot and J.B. Pritzker. But it's not a choice that a lot of other counties want imposed on them, including counties with Democrat state's attorneys and Democrat county sheriffs. Winnebago County has weighed in. We had that op-ed in the Rockford Register Star by Jay Hanley, who's the Will County state's attorney. We invited him to be on the show. He has not accepted our offer. Winnebago County Sheriff Gary Caruana posted a video few days ago that we played in part the other day on the show, and we invited him to be on the show to talk about this in more detail, and he has accepted our offer, and he joins us now. Gary Caruana, County Sheriff, Winnebago County, Illinois. Gary, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Good morning.
Morning. So just give us, you know, the basis why you felt compelled to post this video explaining to your constituents what the Safety Act would mean for their personal safety in Winnebago County.
Hey, just a real quick correction. Jay Hanley is our state's attorney, Winnebago County, not Will.
Oh, did I say Will? I'm sorry, Winnebago County. Yeah, right, of course. Jay, that was in the op-ed that he had in the Rockford Register Star. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Thanks. Sorry about that.
You know, the reason I was compelled to do that is it just doesn't make sense. In law enforcement, it takes everything that we've known and what we try to do to protect the community, the families, and give them the right to, you know, go to a grocery store, go shop freely,
and everybody's concerned and speaks with me as like the crime is really, you know, spiking. Well, it's guess what? It's going to spike even more come January 1 because I have a daily population of 8 to 850, and roughly I'm letting out, again, with this new law, I have no say about it, roughly 400 inmates. And these, you know, these crimes are serious. With that, I know if you've seen, and I know that I mentioned them on the video, but it's aggravated battery, robbery, burglary, and hate crimes, aggravated DUI, think about that, vehicular manslaughter, drug-induced homicide, drug offenses, including trafficking and delivery of fentanyl, which we are many times doing Narcan saves, not once, not twice, but three times, or if not more, intimidation, kidnapping, second-degree murder, aggravated fleeing, and threat to public office, public officials, I'm sorry. And that poses a problem. It's a serious problem. And I'm just concerned that we're not going to have the freedoms that we have. I mean, if you look at the New York law and California and see what's going on there, pretty much so this models it. And it's what compelled me to do the video. I'm very, very, very concerned about our public safety.
Well, people that I spoke with are like, oh, come on, Jacobson, you think they're going to let half the people out of jail? So how does that work? Just explain it to them. Because they're in jail right now for committing these crimes, so why are they going to be released?
Well, you know, again, in the courts right now and the judges are looking at it, who needs to be detained and who doesn't need to be detained and how serious of the crime is it. And the ones I just explained, there's a matrix that they follow, the judicial system, the judges, before pretrial and say, and if it doesn't fit into this House Bill 3653, this Safety Act, which I'm not sure how they named that, but it is what it is, they will be released.
The 400 or so that would be released from your jail, the Winnebago County Jail, these are mainly women who've stolen diapers for their infant children. We understand that from Governor Pritzker. That's who is in jail right now and who needs to be let out, and that's why the Safety Act makes perfect sense.
Well, you know, I heard that, and I actually just came from a conference, a two-day, three-day conference from the Illinois Sheriff's Association, and we had a guest speaker, and I had heard that. I think he spoke in Chicago, too, Pritzker, Municipal League or one of the conferences, and that's what he said, is that nobody's going to be let out of jail. I'm not sure how he says that, unless he's referring to the Department of Corrections the state of Illinois, Joliet, and that system. Well, they're already convicted. This is talking about the county jail pretrial. And I don't know how he can say that, but it has nothing to do with women that have been detained, you know, with their needs of diapers or formula or something. That's such a spin on what's actually happening. Again, these crimes that I just named, that's what we're talking about. I do not have any women up there that are being detained for, you know, diapers or formula. Not at all. We would not even detain them.
Right.
If they're arrested, they'd get a notice to appear for a date in court. If they're arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the aspect of if somebody, you know, decides to camp out in your backyard or live in your garage?
Yeah, that's very, very concerning. And you know, I'll drill down on that a little bit. Is that somebody wants to live in your garage or camp in your backyard? We, you know, listen, we'll come and we'll ask them to leave, and we'll write them a ticket, a notice to appear. Hey, you got to leave. Can't use force to get them off the property. Right now it's being looked at, but it hasn't been determined, you know, if it's a lawful order by a law enforcement officer. Is that obstructing? Can we use force? There's a caveat there, maybe, but that still has to be determined. So now I understand that, and again, this is all open for the appellate court. The homeowner would have to start, you know, eviction processes. That doesn't make sense at all. Keep the garage door shut, I guess, right?
Well, right. So somebody comes into my restaurant and they are being obstreperous in some way, and I call the police. I say, I've asked this person politely to leave. They won't leave. You come, and then they ask him to leave. Maybe they write a ticket, but that's it. Then it's up. That's what I understand. And then it's up to me to decide what to do with them after the police ticket him.
Right. Exactly.
exactly. It's up to you and what degree of threat that you feel and what force you can use. But remember, you'll be held accountable, too. So basically, this law has strategically made the victims have no rights. The criminal have all rights, and the law enforcement are the bad guys. Basically, that's exactly what happened.
Have you you've been talking, I assume, to your deputies about the use of force under this law were to take effect January 1. What are those conversations like?
Well, exactly this. It's just what we're saying. You know, you have to make sure that you document everything, make sure that everything on your probable cause statement that is spelled out completely. So when it does go to the state's attorney's office, that they have enough to provide to the judicial system that if they could be lodged or, again, the risk of flight. And again, we're all on body cams, which I'm glad we are, because it preserves the truth. And most of the time, if not, I can't say there's enough than 100%, but 98% of the time, law enforcement's doing their job and very professional. But, you know, I'm telling them, you know, make sure that, you follow the T of the law properly. And if you feel threatened, then that's where you take action. But, again, that is going to be scrutinized 100% as we move down the road. As you've seen in the videos that the Main Street media is playing, you never see the other side of it. It's just seen that, you know, the deputies or law enforcement had to use force in this situation, and they're going right at law enforcement. And, you know, again, these people are heroes to do what they're doing out there on the street every day.
Talk a little bit, too, because Jim Glasgow, the Will County State's Attorney, has mentioned this idea that if these guys walk and they don't show up, then I have to get order to show cause to get a bench warrant to arrest them. You know, just the whole process of bringing them in, letting them go, then trying to get them back if they aren't abiding the terms of their release. And it just sort of wreaks havoc on the system and the resources available, particularly when you're talking about individuals charged with violent offenses.
Well, exactly. Unfunded mandates, basically. The system, it's burdening the system throughout the criminal justice system completely. I mean, in judicial and law enforcement. But you hit it right on the head. At what point that you ask them, okay, so you have, let's take aggravated battery or robbery. So the state must prove the highest level of, you know, burden of proof that they're at risk of flight, which is very hard to do based on their criminal history, this and the other. So now they go free and they don't show up for their June 10th court date. And so now law enforcement, us, have to go out, find them, and then issue them a notice to appear basically saying, hey, look, you missed your court date on June 10th. Here's another one on July 10th. You know, please be there. And they miss that one, then the warrant is issued. So that's two times that we have to find this individual and then serve them this and then, you know, go out and get them. And if they continue to miss it, what, do they go into the obelisk? At what point are they held accountable to have to answer to the people of the state of Illinois?
This is from Injustice Watch. Okay, Injustice Watch is a proponent of the Safety Act. This is what they say in terms of describing it. A defendant can only be detained in jail pretrial if they're charged with a specific type of felony like murder and sexual assault, and if prosecutors prove to a judge that the defendant is a flight risk or poses a specific real and present threat to any person or the community. But that's the any person piece. This is both with respect to the rules of engagement for police as well as with respect to detaining anyone pretrial. You have to be my read and the read from all these prosecutors that are opposed to it. It cannot be just you make just a general argument that this person committed a violent act and they pose a general threat to the community because of that violent act and perhaps any past violent acts, although the past violent acts can't be used to inform the present violent act. So that's off the table, too. But anyway, a specific person. So this is and this has been used but I'll use it again. So the person who is charged with attempted murder, we have a specific person, the person that they tried to attempt, that they attempted to murder. The person that's charged with murder, they're not a specific threat to anyone in the community necessarily because they already got the person that they were a threat to.
Right. You're reading it right.
So, it's the same thing with police. If they're involved in a confrontation that escalates violently, like somebody, you know, whips out a gun, that's the same. They have to go through the same calculus, too, about is this person, if they're fleeing, can I chase them? Do they pose a threat to the community? Or can I just let them run away and then we'll come back later and pick them up if we can find them?
Well, I think what the state needs to do is to a specific person, and I think these prosecutors need to take into account of persons, meaning the community, and do they pose a threat to the community? I think that's where we can engage. But, again, I've told my deputies, and we have a matrix of when we allowed for, you know, chasing a fleeing, you know, vehicle is, you know, time, date, what's the safety and stuff like that, we'll shut it down. But I'm not going to take that tool away from them and say you're not going to be able to chase. I cannot do that as a good law enforcement. Now, I want to take into account, you know, the safety of the community and what's going on at the time and place and weather and again, time of date. But I think the state needs to prove, and I think the prosecutors are looking at, you know, that caveat of persons, meaning the community, because you can take a, you know, somebody in a domestic you know, shooting the other spouse and killing them, well, then that specific threat is gone because that person's gone, correct?
Right. And the argument that's being made by, again, the proponents here, let's try to address their argument, that this is the reason we're getting rid of cash bail and the reason, I guess, we're putting police on their hind legs is because things have been unfair to people who are on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, and this is a way to balance the scales.
Yeah, I've heard that. I don't agree with it, obviously, being in law enforcement and the sheriff. If you're going to go out and commit a crime, and I feel like society now has become like frogs in the cool water, and it's beginning hotter and hotter. We become desensitized and accepting that baseline of acceptance of saying, hey, look, you know, we don't need a cash bail because we're putting people that commit these crimes, they need to be treated fairly. Well, where's the victim's rights? You know, how are they being treated fairly? I guess you can reverse that and say, well, somebody that has committed a heinous crime can bond out if they have money. I suppose that is the truth there. But where's the victim's rights when you say that? If you do this crime, this is where you're held accountable by the state, and you need to be held accountable. You need to show up for court. You need your sentence, complete your sentence. And here, listen, when we're in my jail, we have programs to help them get off these dangerous drugs, to help them rehabilitate themselves, at least try, and help them get on their feet as they move down the road. Well, now you're taking that ability for law enforcement, corrections, to help them go back in the community. Now you're just taking them and going out. And what is the chances of them reoffending immediately after they're held on bond? I think it's very high.
Yeah, well, we've seen that play out in Cook County for the number of people who've on electronic monitoring who've committed crimes, violent crimes, while on electronic monitoring, awaiting trial for felony charges. In another matter,
get to go stay out for 48 hours.
The other thing too about this crying poor or crying on behalf of the so-called poor, you know, this is judicial discretion too. Prosecutors and public defenders, they make arguments before a judge about bonds. So if somebody's a billionaire and they've got four homes around the world and they're accused of murder, surrender your passport. Maybe they do hold them without bond because they're a flight risk because of their resources. So you take each defendant in context of the flight risk they pose, the resources they have that speak to flight risk, and so on and so forth. So you have somebody that doesn't have resources or has limited resources will often get a lower bond than somebody that does for the same crime because the judges are trying to balance the scale. But that seems to me something that needs to be adjudicated in an adversarial setting with a judge exercising his or her discretion.
Correct, 100%, 100%. I've had one of the state reps say, well, you know, people are losing their homes and their families and, you know, because they're incarcerated for this crime. It's confusing because okay, so somebody that commits a crime and continues to commit a crime, we have to let them out and go back out to, you know, commit another crime. Well, when this person is committing this crime, aren't they thinking of their families and losing their families and their livelihood? I mean, some of these arguments just do not make sense at all. It's just an argument just as, you know.
They really do not.
And it doesn't protect police either. I mean, anybody can call up and allege anything against a police officer, and nothing will get expunged from their record ever if this stays the way it's written.
Right, exactly. You hit it right on the head. And we have to go to LSB, the Training and Standards Board, and make sure, you know, everybody's... And which is fine. I have no problem making sure everybody's trained and certified. I want the most professional officer out there, the most educated and can think their way through cerebrally to make sure that these things don't happen. That's fine. But when you have an anonymous complaint and all of a sudden it goes into their file, and we can't even question as a citizen who's our accuser and what exactly happened. And that's why I'm very happy we're on body cams. And all my deputies never did a pushback at all and in corrections because it preserves the truth. And here it is. I've had people from the street say, well, this officer did this, this, and this. Well, come on in. We'll view the video. And then see what exactly happened, and then we'll deal with it from that point. Oh, you're on body cams? Because they're very hard to see because they're on the vest. And, yeah, we are. Nah, that's all right. Forget it. They won't show up.
He is Gary Caruana. He's the Winnebago County Sheriff out Rockford Way, Winnebago County. Gary, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, and good chatting with you. Thanks. You guys have a great day.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. I'm channeling my inner Charles Dickens because Jamie Dimon is as well. Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan there, saying the economy right now is the classic tale of two cities. There are headwinds and there are tailwinds. It was the season of headwinds. It was the season of tailwinds. And it's hard to make out what's happening. So with apologies to rerun, let's find out what's happening from Steve Moore. He's an economist. He's the author of Trumponomics and most recently GovZilla. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, guys.
Morning. So Fed expected to hike rates by 75 basis points. And then what happens?
I guess I'm on the side. I think the wheels are coming off. I think the economy is in really precarious position. I think that all of these mistakes that we've made, whether it's energy policy or the massive government spending, and you know, the high gas prices, all these things are really weighing down the economy big time. Look, Europe is already in a pretty severe recession. And it was brought on in no small part because of this green energy craziness. And we're headed right over that same cliff, Dan and Amy. I mean, we're making exactly the same mistakes they did. And so the Fed will raise rates by 75 points today. They have to because, you know, when you have 8.5% inflation, you can't go on with that. And finally, Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, has got the rhetoric right. He's saying we have one mission right now, and that's to get inflation down to the 2-3% target that they have. And 8.5% is a long way from 2-2.5%. So they've got a lot of work to do to get inflation down. But I'll tell you, I got into – there's still these huge supply chain problems across the country. I mean, an example, I think I might have mentioned this last week. You know, I flew into O'Hare a week and a half ago for the weekend, and I got in on a Saturday morning. There wasn't a rental car anywhere at O'Hare Airport. You couldn't get one.
They've all been carjacked.
Yeah. No, but I mean, this is happening all the time. You just can't get
you just can't get things you need. I mean, my wife was saying they ran out of milk again at the grocery store. I mean, how can what are we, a third world country? I mean, come on.
Well, Ford right now has hundreds of thousands of vehicles just sitting there because they're waiting for parts to be delivered. So they're thinking, you know, next quarter, 4 to 5 months from now, and then they'll get the parts and they'll put them in the cars and then they'll go to showrooms.
And how can these supply chain problems be happening? I mean, my goodness, we've got Pete Buttigieg on the job. I mean, I thought he was going to solve all that problem, Dan and Amy. I thought that was well behind us. But look, I think the economy is in a soft recession right now. Whether it crashes or not, it's hard to say. But you saw what FedEx announced this week, that their orders are down by about 20%. You're seeing more and more Fortune 500 companies announcing layoffs. So, you know, my advice is, if you've been one of those people on the couch watching Netflix for 2.5 years, collecting all those government benefits, now might be a good time to get a job while they're still out there, because I think it's going to slow down pretty considerably.
Well, those are the tailwinds that Jamie Dimon identified. Of course, plentiful job openings and strong consumer spending. And so those things mitigate.
Where is that consumer spending coming from? Where do you think it's coming from?
Well, the government.
Of course.
Well, it's great.
You pour $4 trillion into the economy.
It's wonderful.
You take helicopters and drop $100 bills out of it. Yeah. Everybody picks them up and goes out and spends. And this is such an artificial balloon economy. It is going to bust.
As long as John Podesta keeps spending money they printed, everything should be fine. Right?
I mean, just so people know what we're talking about. I mean, I don't know whether we should be laughing or just completely outraged, but Joe Biden has given John Podesta, who's the biggest, the number one Democratic political operative who knows nothing about business, but he knows a lot about politics and sucking up to people like Obama and Biden. He's going to be controlling the world's biggest slush fund in the history of mankind. $320 billion.
Oh,
$320 billion for John Podesta. I don't think he's going to give me one of those grants. Do you?
No.
Well, I don't know. Depends how good of a windmill you build, I suppose. But yeah. No, So if it's all artificial, or if it's largely artificial based on funny money that's been printed and
funny
is being
money,
spent by John Podesta, then what happens, say, 4 or 5 months from now, when that funny money has run through the economy amid a credit crunch brought on by higher interest rates?
Yeah, I mean, good question. What happens? I think that at that point, the economy really crashes. We got to start cutting off this government spending. It's having two negative effects. Number one is when you put all that money in the economy, obviously it's going to cause prices to go up. I mean, this is not complicated, right? More dollars in the economy is going to create higher inflation. That's what Mexico and Bolivia and Argentina and Venezuela do, and that never has worked out too well. But the other negative side of this is it's harder and harder all the time for companies to get workers. I mean, I can't tell you how many times we will go out to a restaurant or any kind of service industry, and they just don't have the people to do it anymore. I mean, what would we do without? I went to a major kind of factory in Wisconsin a couple of weeks ago when I was out in the Chicago area. And this guy has about, I won't mention his company, but he has about 400 employees. He's got a big refrigeration company. And he said, "Steve, come on out back in the, the warehouse and see the guys, what we got going on back there." I go out there, and down in Amy, I'm not joking. Two-thirds of the people were Hispanics. Most of them look like they just came over, those are the people working as the immigrants. Maybe we need more of these migrants.
Yeah, right.
Because it's hard to get the Americans to do the job. But those are really hardworking people. I'm not saying this disparagingly. They're really hardworking people. And,
of course.
And they're the ones who are keeping our company, our country flowing. But where are the Americans? They're watching Netflix.
So people have been trying to sort of figure out this riddle of how so many people can not be looking for work, so many people can be out of the workforce for so long and make ends meet. And I wonder if, we were looking at it incompletely when we were looking at sort of the COVID relief checks, and we weren't taking into account the amount of PPP fraud. So it wasn't $1,500 or $3,000 that's sustaining people. It's $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 grants that the federal government is never going to audit that people got away with.
Dan, maybe just from the unemployment benefit program, this one program that we vastly expanded under the, what do they call it, the American Recovery Act or something like that. The amount of fraud and erroneous payments, you know how much it was?
How much?
Want to take a guess? $146 billion. $146 billion. That's almost as big as the entire, you know, Illinois state budget. I mean, you're probably way above that now, but it used to be about that big. And, you know, think about it. And nobody does a damn thing about it. That's just one program. How much fraud do you think there is in the food stamp program? How much fraud do you think there is in the earned income tax credit program? How much fraud do you think there was in the rental assistance program? I mean, I could speak for a half hour. We are wasting money. And by the way, a lot of that fraudulent money, you know where it went? Oh, the people living in Russia and Mexico. It didn't, I guess it's stimulating the economy. It's just not stimulating the economy here in the United States. it's a weird picture, though. I mean, Jamie Dimon is right, because the other thing that's going on that people should be paying attention to is the strength of the dollar. Have you been following this at all, Dan? Relative to all these other currencies,
yes.
It's soaring. Now, that's kind of good news and bad news. It's good news if you want to go to – now's a good time to go take a trip to Italy or, you know, Spain or go to Europe. I mean, you can buy a lot with your dollars there. But it's because we're the tallest midget, right? All these other countries have screwed up their economy so much. And you look around the world and you're like, where is the leadership? Where is – show me one country – that's moving in the right direction.
Well, at least Liz Truss or the UK is talking about growth. We'll see what she does, but
that's
at least she's talking growth.
Yeah.
And in Switzerland, they want you to shower with family members to cut down on
climate.
Take one for the team.
Well,
that's not uncomfortable.
It doesn't have to be family member, just group.
Oh, just group?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, it doesn't have to be family. Maybe your neighbors, you could do a group shower.
Sure.
Know?
I mean, whoever.
Forget the block party.
I have to confess, you know, I did take a bath with my sister when I was 4 years old.
Yes, we all.
I hope we all
bathed with our siblings.
I hope that's subsided at this point. Yeah.
Somehow this interview just got weird.
Yeah. All right. So going back to Liz Truss, and she's trying to dig the merry old England out of what could be a real deep recession with energy, with the price of energy alone there. But I wonder if Western.
Do you know what they're paying for gasoline in London right now?
Yeah, you said $11, right? A gallon?
$9, $10, $11 a gallon.
Right.
I mean, my God. That, by the way, Joe Biden would love that, wouldn't he? I mean, then nobody would drive a car.
So if Western Europe and maybe China, even informally, if they go into a deep recession, I mean, how do we not get pulled into that too?
Yeah, good point. And Japan's in tough times too. I mean, the whole world has moved. It feels like the 1970s. There's no pro freedom leader. You said maybe the new, what's her name again?
Liz Truss.
Maybe. I don't know if she's a Margaret Thatcher, but we just need new leadership. And this always happens whenever the United States moves to the left, as we have. The whole world tends to move to the left, and that's dangerous. I mean, I'll tell you, there was the World Health Organization just did this idiotic report saying you know what the most dangerous virus is today?
What?
Climate change. Oh. Climate change. We have to spend hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars more on climate change. And I'm saying, no, you know what the most dangerous thing to the world is that's going to kill a lot more people than climate change?
Democrats.
And the COVID? Yeah, well, you put it a little differently than that. It's the movement away from economic freedom. It's going to cause poverty around the world. Now, in the United States, it means, you know, we might not be able to, you know, we have to reduce our living standard. In other countries, when the global economy goes through one of these, reductions, you see people literally malnutrition, hunger, starvation. I mean, this is bad news. How complicated is this, Dan? Economic freedom causes growth, and socialism causes deprivation. It's the lesson of the 20th century, and none of these idiots have learned that lesson.
Steve Moore, free market economist and GovZilla author. Steve, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys, have a great weekend. Take care.
You too, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day. then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. COVID consequences. Inputs and outputs. Connection between the two. Politico reporting. New York spent $250 million on tech to fight COVID that no one uses. Mm-hmm. We're just talking to Steve Moore about the amount of fraud, theft associated with all the COVID relief funds. We've talked about it as well. Whether it's criminal operators in this country or international criminal operations, hundreds of billions of dollars reportedly.
There's
pilfered.
Two scam testing sites that were, they made millions of dollars, and they're right here in the Chicago area. And they're throwing the tests in the garbage.
In New York, the state acquired 8,555 ventilators at a cost of about $166 million, 1,179 X-ray machines for $86 million. And now they're stacked in warehouses across New York with no plans to distribute them or put them to any immediate use. Of course, we know and we knew fairly early on that treating COVID with a ventilator wasn't really the way to go.
No. Yeah. It exacerbated the conditions in some patients, too.
And now hospitals have plenty of what they need in terms of ventilators and X-ray machines to deal with their immediate needs. So you say, well, this is stockpiling for a future point in time. And then if that future point in time doesn't come in the relatively near future, then those machines become obsolete with technological innovation. But I digress. New York is already starting to dispose of 700,000 gallons of expired hand sanitizer that was made in 2020 by people serving time in New York prisons. That'll take 44 weeks to complete by shipping 168 trailer loads 130 miles from Utica to Rochester at a cost of $2.5 million. California scrambled to get 14,000 ventilators that were hardly used. Canada ordered 40,000 ventilators, more than half of which were never unwrapped. In 2020, the Trump administration rushed to order nearly 200,000 ventilators at a cost of $3 billion. A medical review found that only half of them even had the capacity to support the most severely affected patients. This according to the American College of Chest Physicians, which I know you're a member in good standing.
Yes, please. Mm-hmm. I did pay my dues this month.
Just, you know, hundreds of millions here, billions there. Do they work? Did they provide a return on investment? This, in part, is the subject of a piece I found interesting over at City Journal, our friends at City Journal of Manhattan Institute, by Corbin Barthold. And it speaks to, you know, bureaucracy, but what he speaks to in his piece implicates what we're talking about with the just catastrophic waste and the willy-nilly distribution of other people's resources. You know, the bureaucracy piece, though, that's all of our lives. It's not just public sector. It's private sector, too. You know, like filing your TPS reports.
Hello, Peter. What's happening? We have sort of a problem here. Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that. I forgot.
Yeah. You see, we're putting the cover sheets on all TPS reports now before they go out. Did you see the memo about this?
Yeah, I have the memo right here. I just forgot, but it's not shipping out till tomorrow, so there's no problem.
Yeah. If you could just go ahead and make sure you do that from now on, that would be great. And I'll go ahead and make sure you get another copy of that memo, okay?
Yeah, no, I have the memo. I've got it. It's right.
Hello, Phil.
And you're going to need to work Saturday.
Gary Cole is just genius in that movie. He's a great actor, great comedic actor.
He's not here.
And he's also essentially a representative of every middle manager in government, as far as I can tell. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Corbin Barthold. He's the Internet Policy Counsel at Tech Freedom. Corbin, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. I love that you're kicking us off with the Office Space clip.
Yeah, any way we can shoehorn that into the show, it's such a classic. But so this was the topic of your piece that I referenced, this the complexity, redundancy, inanity, a la Office Space, of our ever-expanding bureaucracy, and we think of that in the public sector, but it implicates the private sector too.
Yeah, and that's one insight of the piece, or really the people whose work I touch on in the piece. Cass Sunstein, a legal scholar, he uses the term sludge for, the shorthand is red tape, which we've all been complaining about forever. But he means it in the broadest possible sense, including waiting time, clearance processes, reviews, duplicative application requirements, all the things that get between you and getting stuff done or getting something purchased. And it's not just the government. It's, as anyone knows who's worked or has a large bank for their bank accounts or an insurance company. Just the other day, my wife was trying to get an inhaler prescription for our little child who has pneumonia, and it took her half an hour because the face mask that goes with the inhaler has to have a certain size, but then the insurer has a coding requirement that they didn't have a setting for the size, so the insurer was blocking it, paying the thing, and they were arguing with the person at the drug counter, and, whatever, you can pay the $8 in that context. So that's a great small example. If it's the cancer drug, it's way more serious. And Michael Mazar actually is a great term for this, predatory abstract systems, where the system that is far too complicated for any normal person to understand who's not deep in it, even some of the people working in it don't understand, comes out and, you get a $10,000 bill from the IRS, and that's bad enough because they've made a mistake. But then the real insult is you can't get a real human. You get a new form when you protest that has some other error on it, that sort of thing. And, we're drowning in it.
Yeah, the problem, of course, in terms of trying to unwind this, particularly in the public sector, is that cottage industries are built up around the complexity. So the more, Rube Goldbergian the scheme, the more you need, in the IRS example, accountants and tax attorneys and so on and so forth to help you navigate. And so you create stakeholders because of the legal requirement for compliance and the money at stake.
Oh, it's a devilish problem. And the tax code is atrocious with the number of loopholes and how complicated, sedimentary layers of exceptions upon exceptions and compromises that leads to, it's a nuisance. It's a cost on society. As you say, interest groups get in the way of reform. It's inequitable. I mean, it's unfair because if you're rich, you can throw money at the problem. And if you're not rich, you have to spend all your time on it. And then it's a devilish problem because I would also add, you talk about, say, fraud. One big source of sludge that is not coming from a bad place is it sometimes gets put there to verify it. It's to make sure that the person getting the benefit actually deserves the benefit. That often is itself another source of sludge.
And right. I mean, so that's a piece of it. But then it's just this fundamental problem. I mean, it's, as explained, this is, James Buchanan won a Nobel Prize explaining public choice theory. But just going back to the public sector, people just don't spend other people's money as judiciously as they spend their own. And if there's no bottom line sensitivity, then you're going to have stories like we were recounting about the waste associated with the COVID response.
They're certainly related. I'm not going to say they're unconnected, but in principle, sludge is a slightly different thing because you could have, take Denmark or whatever, where their government's bigger than it should be, but they're not suffering the degree of waste that we probably would if we tried to impose that system. There's a lot of factors at play. You can efficiently give away a lot of money, and that's a bad idea. whereas we actually manage to be the worst of all worlds. We waste a lot of money, and we do it in a really inefficient, Rube Goldberg-esque manner. We kind of we manage to hit the grand slam on that.
Yeah, but I mean, right. But bureaucracies have to justify themselves, particularly if they want to continue to expand, which is sort of how the inertia always drives them. And so you have to distribute what you were given and ask for more. And, you know, it's the whole, you know, our money has to be spent, because if we return any money, then we're not going to get as much as we did last year. And that's sort of the attitude about government, generally speaking, across the partisan spectrum. It's and thus it, you know, always grows no matter who's in charge. It's just the rate of growth that we're really discussing.
Yeah, no, that's right. It is funny. I know people even down at the level of contractors in D.C. who that's not like a made up thing in urban legend. It really is like, oh, it's the end of the fiscal year. We need to spend this money so that we can justify it as our budget line item. That's absolutely a thing. And it is, it's more than money. So I'll pick on like Yale University as a prime offender here. They have something like 6,000 undergraduates. They have 5,000 or so administrators. That is an insane ratio. It reminds me of the old joke about the Department of Agriculture, you know, where Bill and Frank cross each other in the hallway, and Frank is crying, and Bill says, "Frank, why are you crying?" And he says, "My farmer died."
I love that joke. And yeah, I've told that joke on the air, and it doesn't get anything. I don't. Maybe it's the delivery. But no, I love that joke.
It's more than money. It's programs, it's events. You know, if you're an administrator at Yale, it's not just the money. It's you have to justify your existence in all kinds of ways that actually gets in the way of other people going about their lives.
Well, right. And you know, all that money spending, too. I mean, again, this is basic economics. All that money being spent to prop up bureaucracies also crowds out private investment. It crowds out the efficient use of those resources that, you know, could potentially have a positive multiplier even in the public sector. So there are, you know, second and third level consequences.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not, but, you know, I do want to say there should be, this is something where there should be a degree of bipartisan agreement, and there's not, unfortunately, where whatever program you're going to have, if you're not claiming that, say, you want to eliminate the entire food stamp program or not tax people, like, you're still going to want that system to work, and we're terrible at that.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of terrible, you wrote in your article that with cityjournal.org about President Obama's first term and the sludge fighters. Can you explain that?
Sure. So the term sludge, I'm borrowing that from the legal scholar Cass Sunstein, who is a Democrat. He was the head of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs under the Obama administration. And there is a law called the Paperwork Reduction Act in on the books, and he was trying to implement that and get the federal government to be better about not forcing duplicative paperwork requirements on small businesses, and to make it easier if you are really do benefits to be able to, you know, fill out simpler forms to get them, that sort of thing. He does good work in this area. He is a great example when I point to, you know, this should be something that we can find some bipartisan agreement on. I will say, although he's fighting the good fight, it's a perfect example of he and others in the administrations, both Democrat and Republican, bang this drum, and it doesn't really seem to do anything. As Dan was saying, we are often sort of arguing over how fast things will deteriorate rather than whether anything will improve.
Although, ironically, I mean, Cass Sunstein, once upon a time, was promoting the idea of regulating people's personal email communications.
Oh.
So, you know, who regulates who deregulates the deregulators, I guess, to some extent, too.
His output is vast. Yes. Well, if you look at the Biden administration, and I get into this in the piece, that's the thing is, part of what makes the problem so devilish is how do you fight sludge? Well, you come up with a new layer of bureaucracy that's now the anti-bureaucracy bureaucratic layer. I mean, they circulated memos around the federal government that where government
officials are now going to create a committee, and the committee is going to do work to figure out how there will be fewer committees. And
right. It's like Monty Python quality stuff. It really is. He is Colin Barthold. Corbin Barthold, that is, Internet Policy Counsel at Tech Freedom. Check out his piece, Sludge Kills, at city-journal.org. Corbin, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Spend all this time discussing whether income inequality is necessarily a bad thing or a good thing, or it's just a thing. There's always going to be a distribution of unequal distribution of resources, even in the most totalitarian of states. In fact, that's where you see the disparity the greatest. For example, San Francisco, the greatest income inequality in the country by some measures. Our next guest has authored a book arguing that American inequality is a myth. It's not even whether it is a good thing or a bad thing. It doesn't exist. How could that be? We're pleased to be joined by former United States Senator from Texas, former presidential candidate, former chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, Phil Graham, non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and again, the new book, The Myth of American Inequality, How Government Biases Policy Debate. Senator Graham, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, listen, thank you. So let me tell you the basic point of the book.
Okay.
The Census Bureau, in calculating income based on assumptions going back to 1947, does not count two-thirds of all transfer payments as income to the recipients. So, for example, when the government gave this big tax credit last year, it did not count as income to the people who received it the way the census measures income. And as a result, the official poverty measure did not change, even though the amount of money transferred was large enough to reduce the poverty level among children dramatically. And so what we do in this book is we go back and look at what the census actually calculates, compare it to the level of government spending going to different parts of the income distribution. And basically what we conclude is that when you count all transfer payments, that's everything from tax credits, which you get in a treasury check, which they don't count, to food stamps that you get a credit card, which is not counted, to rent subsidies, to 100 other federal, state, and local programs, that when you count all that spending, that since 1965, when the war on poverty started, government transfers to the bottom 20% of American earners has risen from $9,800 to $45,400. And also, the census doesn't take into account taxes, which you never see. The government withholds them. So the bottom line is, the census says that the bottom 20% of American earners have an income compared to the top 20%, that the top 20% has 16.7 times as much income. We show that when you count all transfer payments and taxes, it's only 4-1. So whatever you think about how much income should be redistributed in a free society, there's a big difference between 4-1 and 16.7-1. We also show that when you count all transfer payments as income, the poverty rate is between 2 and 3%, and not 14.5%, which the official number shows.
Since
so, does a lot of other things, but that's the crux of the income inequality part of it.
Since the left is loath to debate anybody who doesn't agree with them, so not much of a debate if you're only talking to people who agree with you. Let's do it in absentia. Timothy Noah wrote a critique of your book and your argument in New Republic, as I'm sure you're not surprised. Here's what he writes in part. I want to get you to respond to this. So the real story over the last 40 years is the decline in middle class incomes. And he writes, as life gets no better for the middle class and government programs make life somewhat better for the poor, the difference between being middle class and poor becomes blurry. I don't doubt this creates middle class resentment, but it's perverse for Graham, that would be you, to want to resolve this by making the poor poorer.
Well, first of all, I don't want to make anybody poor. I want to make people better off. And I think you would make people better off if you had a work requirement with means-tested transfers. In 1965, 68% of work-age people in the bottom quintile of income earners worked. Today, it's 36%. Hmm. With new transfer payments, the labor force participation rate, as you know, is falling in the second tier and the middle tier of income. So he's simply seizing a point we make, which is that not only is income inequality one-fourth of what the government statistics show, which he doesn't dispute, obviously, but also transfer payments are so generous now that the difference between middle-income working families and people who are simply drawing government benefits is quite small. And we make the point that it's created two problems. One, if you give people as much for not working as they can make working, you shouldn't be shocked they don't work. And secondly, there is a political resentment that you're working hard, your wife's working hard, you're barely paying your bills, and somebody lives down the block that's not breaking a sweat. So we point out that this is probably the roots of what we call political populism today, this economic resentment. When's the last time you ever heard a working person complain about Warren Buffett being rich? I've never heard it, but I hear him complain about people that aren't breaking a sweat that are about as well off as they are. So I don't see that as an answer to the book.
Right. And the left, I mean, it seems it's a clash of values too, right? I mean, the left's response to this and the decline in middle income families' real income is to say, well, just become a state dependent as well. Just increase expand the reach of the programs and increase the levels of support.
Well, look, the more people you have riding in the wagon, the harder the wagon is to pull. Our argument in the book is that we need a mandatory work requirement for able-bodied work-age people that are receiving means-tested benefits, like we had the welfare reform under Clinton, which was very successful.
Right.
But it only did one program, aid to families with dependent children. We need to do all the programs. And secondly, the point we're making is that if you want to give people an opportunity to succeed in America, that opportunity is through working. It's not through earning government benefits. We also make the point that the second largest determinant of income inequality is the quantity and quality of education. And the failure of inner city schools is a major contributor to the ability of low-income people to develop their talent, to get on the playing field, and to compete. And that's what we're arguing. I want everybody richer. I don't want anybody poor. And finally, let me say, that America never promised equality of outcome. The American founders always understood that liberty and equality are sworn and everlasting enemies. When one lives, the other dies. What we promised was a fair chance and an open way to get on the playing field of life and compete. And we show in the book that if you look at mobility numbers, the number of people who live in households when they grow up that are better, higher income than they had as children, that 93% of people in the bottom 20% of income earners have more income than their parents did. That's the American promise in action. And also, about two-thirds of the people in the bottom quintile move into a higher quintile than their parents. That is, they not only make more money and stay in the same quintile, but about 9% of them go all the way to the top quintile. So opportunity is alive and well in America, and we can make it more alive and healthier if we have a mandatory work requirement for receiving means-tested benefits.
He is former United States Senator Phil Graham, former chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His new book, which we've been discussing, The Myth of American Inequality, How Government Biases Policy Debate. Senator Graham, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Bye.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.